It's paradise over there. On the one hand, you can't believe the beauty. On the other hand, they don't even have toilets.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 375 for the week of October 4th, 2021. I am Speaker from the House, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Jailhouse Buddhist, Sarah D. Bunting.
Fucking Mussolini.
Wet Stare Fall Survivor, Tara Ariano.
We are tailbone strong.
And balding 20-something gangster, Alan Sepinwall.
Every time I think I'm out, they pull my toupee back off!
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Joining us, who else could we possibly get to talk about the many saints of Newark but Alan Sepinwall, the
Chief
of Miracle Magazine!
Hey, guys!
Yay! Welcome, Alan. We are here, as I said.
I'm so happy to be back.
We're going to talk about the many saints of Newark. This is the Sopranos prequel movie. Narrated by Christopher Moltisanti from Beyond the Grave, this initially sends us back to 1967, where a young Anthony Soprano idolizes his uncle, maid guy Dickie Moltisanti. Young Tony is drawn to Dickie in part because Dickie is nice to him, unlike his parents. But there's a lot about Dickie that Tony doesn't know, starting with but not limited to how various people in Dickie's orbit actually ended up dead. The movie premiered in theaters and on HBO Max on October 1st. We're going to be talking about all of it. Let's do the Chen check-in. Alan, should our listeners watch The Many Saints of Newark?
If they love The Sopranos, I think they should. Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Sarah?
Nope.
What?
Oh, boy.
I can't wait to get into this.
All right, we're for it. All right.
Dave?
Your mileage may vary based on your love of Sopranos.
Yeah.
Having watched it, I think I could have lived a full life without having watched it. Not mad at it.
That's really where I am.
God knows I've consumed some lackluster Star Wars content over the years because I like to visit that universe, and I feel like that's where I am with this.
Yeah. If you watched The Sopranos, you're going to watch it anyway. And if
exactly.
you didn't watch yeah. The Sopranos, this is not where to start.
Yeah.
Is my take. So some would say there's a lot to talk about here. I think we should confine our discussion today entirely to Uncle Junior falling down the wet stairs at the church, which really spoke to me as a fellow stair faller. Just kidding. Let's actually get into the real questions. Alan, should
yes.
this movie be the last villain origin story, or would you even classify it that way?
I'm not even sure. It's a very odd movie, and I really liked it in pieces. I'm not sure exactly how I would classify it. I mean, you know, I wound up doing a whole lot of stories about the movie for Rolling Stone. I interviewed everybody involved, and David Chase, who created the show and co-wrote the movie, among other things, like a lot of people told me even before I talked to him that Chase was adamant he wanted the movie to be 2 hours or less because he feels like movies that are longer than that annoy him.
Yep.
And watching this feels like a movie that is missing at least a half an hour to an hour of material. And so even though I really enjoy a lot of it in isolated pieces, it takes a lot of shortcuts. It jumps around a lot. There's a lot of missing stuff, especially involving Dickie Moltisanti, because at least with like young Tony and young Livy and Junior and the others, you can fill in the blanks yourselves because you've watched The Sopranos.
Right.
With the new people, you can't do that. And so it's just sort of like, wait a minute, how did we get here? Wait,
right.
Why are these two having sex together? You know, a lot of different things, a lot of like head scratchers. Even though I enjoyed it overall, I'm also sort of a very extra Sopranos viewer.
Right.
So, you know, that is where I land.
Watching it, I thought like the same kind of thing. It did feel like it was truncated in certain parts, but it also felt like it kind of wanted to be a more than a movie. It kind of wanted to drift into maybe a miniseries
to be
or
a
something
show.
Like that.
Yeah, it just felt like Chase wanted to hang out with these characters more so than like have a plot arc. Sarah, I feel like our listeners are shocked by your Chen check-in answer. So is your issue that you didn't want to, like, that you feel Sopranos was perfect as it was? You didn't want to go back, or you would have gone back, but this isn't what you would have chosen?
I did like parts of it. I had problems with a lot of it, but I didn't, like, net, I didn't hate it. The problem is not, a quality issue. It's a reason to exist issue, which a number of other critics have brought up.
Yeah.
And I just, like, I got to the end of it and was not upset that I had watched it, but I also do not need to revisit it, do not even need to consider it canon. Like, look, Sopranos is Lifetime my favorite show, but it's not a perfect egg. There's a, there's a lot of sort of garbage in there, like false starts, whatever. Like, it didn't have to be perfect. And I was very primed to like it. And while I was watching it, I enjoyed the experience, but it's not good exactly. It's just like there's a lot of stuff that feels fan servicey. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of performances that, like, why the fuck do you waste Billy Magnussen as Pauly? He gets like nothing to do. He has this ridiculous prosthetic nose.
Not the only one.
No. Farmiga's was not bothersome to me, and I thought that performance was outstanding and really well observed. Like, there are things in here that are good, but another problem I had, leaving aside the fact that the guy playing Dickie Moltisanti, Alessandro Nivola, looks like three quarters Andrew Cuomo and one quarter David Provol, which, like,
yeah,
just bugged me. That I was like, why is the governor still here? Like, could somebody please kill that guy? Is he supposed to be out of office? Janice, shoot him. This character just seemed like such a miss to attach the point of view to. Mm. When you had so many, like, Giuseppina was so much more interesting. Uncle Sal was so much more interesting. Like, Leota, like, finally Leota is in this universe, and Summit's own Ray Leota. And if for no other reason, this film should exist in order to have accomplished that. But, like, the Uncle Sal Chronicles, I would watch that all day.
To add to why Ray Leota is fantastic in this movie and doing mental exercises, there is a first night back when he comes back from Italy, sexcapade, where Dickie is just in the next room listening to him having sex with his Italian bride-to-be. And I was just imagining that Ray Liotta had to go in and do ADR for this. And that's behind-the-scenes scene I want to see. I think that would be fantastic.
Alan, you were frowning real hard while Sarah was praising Ray Liotta. Do you disagree?
No, I think he's great. The amazing thing is actually, like, apparently, at least according to him, and I've heard some conflicting things about this since I published something, Leota claims that, like, he was only hired to play Hollywood Dick, and they were negotiating with someone else to be Uncle Sally, and the other actor wanted too much money, and so they just went to him. He's so good as Uncle Sally. Like, this is one of the best things I've seen him do. It's so reserved and intense. For all the issues I have with the Dickie story, the last scene that the two of them have together, you know, maybe some of the things you're doing aren't God's favorite.
Aren't
I got
God's
chills.
Favorite. So gentle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I loved him in this. He Farmiga and Michael Gandolfini are the three sort of, like, great performances here in my mind.
Oh, Gandolfini. He was very cute. But before we move on from
Gandolfini, I love
before we move on from Billy Magnussen, there was a tweet a couple weeks ago from @BobbyBigWill on Twitter about the casting of Chris Pratt as the voice of Mario in the Mario Brothers movie that's coming. And this Twitter user wrote, Chris Pratt is a Gentile and as such is not party to the 1947 treaty between Jews and Italians that allows us to play each other in movies. He does not come from a yelling-based culture. It's kind of how I feel about Polly Walnuts being played by this fucking Viking, Billy Madison. Alan and I have discussed this already. Please speak on this, Alan.
It's definitely like, all right, so you've got Magnussen as Pauly. You have Corey Stoll as Junior. He at least qualifies under the treaty because he's a member of the tribe.
Same with John Bernthal as Johnny Soprano.
Yes, exactly. So you've got a couple of, you know, my Jewish brethren there crossing over successfully and very entertaining. Magnussen, I mean, if you look at photos of the young Tony Sirico around this time, he looks like a stud. He does not look like a Viking god in the same way that Billy Magnussen does.
No.
So you have to let that go.
Billy Magnussen has played a charming sociopath to, you know, I was like the only one who watched that show. And he, like, sent me an email that was like, thanks for watching this. Even my mom did not watch this, but, like, he's perfectly capable. I always love him.
Yeah.
Give him something to do. That literally the only thing he does is, you know, I can't really do it in a podcast, that famously visual medium, but, like, that, you know, to the two fingers, like the Texas horns, but, like, turned to one side, Pauly pointing with the pinky, like, there was nobody else anywhere on the lot at Silver Cup that looked anything like Sirico. Just D.H. Sirico. He lives down the street from me. I'll go ask him for you.
Based on like how's the like Luke Skywalker looked on Mandalorian, I don't know that you want that.
Yeah. Right.
I well, I mean, there's want and then there's want. I mean,
no, but again, John Magaro looks more like Polly, like Tony Sirico than pre making him over to look like Silvio than Billy Magnuson does.
Well, all right. So I got to ask you guys about Magaro because he seems to be a real flashpoint. There are folks who think like, oh, this is embarrassing. He's doing an SNL sketch. And then there's my argument, which is Steve Van Zandt was already doing an SNL sketch.
Like,
I love
him. I agree.
That's the broadest fucking performance on that show by a country mile.
Yep.
So,
I mean, just this is what he does with his mouth qualifies as an SNL character by itself, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Having Christopher as the narrator telling the story of the father he never really knew seems to be because, you know, the Dickie-Tony relationship prefigures what we see with Tony and Chris in some ways. Did we need this movie to understand that?
No.
Oh, I don't know. Okay, so here's the deal. So Alan and Sarah are very much fans of the show and are immersed in it. Again, I'll just say, like, in the same way that I could tell you who's who in Star Wars and all that kind of stuff. Like, but this movie was a lot of me going to Tara, who's that supposed to be? Is that a new character? Is this somebody I know from the show? Because it wasn't like, except for the super obvious ones like Gandolfini, I was having some trouble. So even though the dead are speaking framing is cliche and tired and kind of lazy, I feel like those shortcuts I was fine with because I was having a little trouble with one-to-one character comparisons and figuring out who I knew and who they were introducing.
I didn't have a problem with it. Like, I thought the performance was good and I thought it was the best of the available options, which I think I read about in Alan's piece. I think of the available options, that was the best one. I mean, I'm reminded of like the first Sex and the City movie and how basically like that isn't good either, but it knew what it was supposed to be, which was basically like five episodes mooshed together and some fan service stuff, which it did. And then it did it again. And that was a mistake. And this upcoming thing, the less said, the better. Although, of course, I'm going to watch it because I hate myself. But this, I think, was like, I think that David Chase has always had this ability to sort of understand what fans want and the answers that they want and then give us what he wants anyway. So I'm a little unclear about, I would just have liked to be in the room when it was being talked through, like how much of this is really going to be like, you know, shout outs basically to the show. And how much of this is going to be like a new story that is interesting to him? Because there were so many other characters that they should have just put the camera over their shoulder. And but then one of them is Harold McBrayer. And I just that was part of the movie that I felt like wanted to be its own thing and didn't work because I'm just not sure in the hands of this author that the concerns of the black citizen of Newark in 1967 is, I just don't know if I would go that way.
Those were the moments where I felt like it wanted to break out into a series, what I was saying before, where there was sort of like starts of tangents related storylines, you know, sort of like getting into the grander universe that is happening there that then were like just ended. I felt prematurely because it's 2 hours. It's not a series.
Alan, what do you think of the framing device?
Well, I mean, he talked about it with me and he talked about it, I know, with Marc Maron as well. The idea that like the framing device was one of the things they added a year later when they came back for additional shooting. And I think it was part because test audiences admitted that like Dave, they were having a hard time following who's this? How does this relate to this?
Right.
And so, like, they tried Carmella, I think, was supposed to tell a joke or something, and then she would narrate, and I don't know what Paulie Walnuts was going to do. This obviously has the closest connection, and it links them in. And then I believe also the stuff at the funeral parlor at the very end of the movie was also a late addition. Because I think that they'd shot a different kind of ending for Tony that Alan Taylor told me about, where you just sort of, like, see young Tony walking down the street with his friends, and one second he's like the carefree kid, and then he's lost in thought, and by the end of the shot, like he is Tony Soprano.
Right.
Which would have been really interesting too. But I liked what Imperioli was doing. I like that they don't do too much of it. I think it adds sort of this layer of, I mean, they call this a Soprano story, and you can kind of look on it as how reliable a narrator is Christopher. A bunch of the things that we see here are not as they were either shown or described on the TV show, like the, you know, when Johnny Boy shoots Livy in the beehive hairdo, it's supposed to be Junior in the backseat. So there's a lot of like inconsistencies that were deliberately put there. And it sort of, it raises this question for you. How much am I of what I'm watching? Am I supposed to believe both the new stuff and the old stuff? And I like that ambiguity in terms of how The Sopranos always used to function. It's just
same.
The movie's just trying to do so many things. And Harold is definitely one of the ones who suffers the most. Giuseppina is one of the ones who suffer most. And then suddenly the two of them are together. I mean, I know you sort of see them looking at each other from across the room a couple times, but that really just comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and then her whole like confession scene on the beach is like, I just don't think this sort of sparky character who we think is like, you know, part of this is her like, you know, the scales falling from her eyes. Like she learns English, but also the ways of the Italian Americans among whom she is posted up. But it's like, I just don't think that she would tell a like her gangster boyfriend, like, I fucked it's, anyone else or even thought about it. Like, no way.
Yeah. One of the things that's great about The Sopranos and that I think distinguishes it from a lot of the shows that have imitated it since is it has great female characters and it gives them empathy and it gives them dimension, even when they're terrible, even when they're like Janice or Livy or whomever, they're really complex. And Giuseppina does not get that at all in this. She's just sort of there as, you know, an object lesson.
She's Apollonia from The Godfather, basically.
Yeah, but much better act. I liked the performance, and I think that DeRossi was doing more with it than was on the page. A lot of people were, I think. But yeah, I think trying to do too much is basically it in a nutshell. And again, did not hate it. Do not consider it canonical, honestly, and like that's fine.
I am loath to give Amazon Prime any credit for anything to do with user experience, but if this had the X-ray feature from Amazon Prime, this would probably be the first time I would actually use it in earnest. 1 point for Amazon Prime. I'm like the judge from The Good Fight. Ding! 1 point for Prime.
It's funny because I remember when they announced what the movie was going to be and I heard what the name was. My assumption is, okay, it's Baltasanti is Italian for many saints. This will be the story of Dickie. I wouldn't put it past David Chase to basically make a movie that is entirely about Dickie, where all the people that we know are really minor figures. Like that seems a very David Chase kind of thing to do.
Yeah.
And I think that there probably is a version of that movie where like he gives over entirely to the new story. And that works, I think, better than it does here, even though parts of it, I think, are still very good. But then at a certain point, I think he just realized, I love these characters. I know the audience loves them. I want to give them more.
Yep.
Obviously, Vera was great. You know, Michael Gandolfini's great. The section of the movie where, like, it's him going to the guidance counselor and then him and Livia talking in the kitchen, like, that's some of the best stuff in the whole movie. But it kind of derails the movie because we've just had a bunch of, like, Harold and Dickie stuff all in a row, and then they just vanish for like 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So it's, I think maybe if it had just been the Dickie Moltisanti story, it would work better as the kind of gangster movie he wanted to do. And eventually he's trying to just juggle both the show and the fan service and the movie itself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you guys think about the tone? Because I felt like the movie, compared to the series, lacked sort of those lighter, darkly comedic moments that Sopranos is known for. This felt more like, kind of like a Scorsese kind of take on it and less the TV show. Like it had a little less fizz to it.
I agree. I think there was like kind of a basic misapprehension about how much we would care about this central character. That's the engine. And that's my main problem with it is like that. I think we are supposed to not substitute Dickie for Tony, but to see them as very analogous figures, one of whom was a big influence on the other, and then the other was the influence on that one's son, et cetera, and so on. But Dickie Moltisanti is not someone we've spent any time with before, and he looks like fucking Andrew Cuomo, which is a problem, and then he's sort of like struggling not to cry when he's visiting his uncle in jail, and it's like I felt like we were supposed to attach to this person as the same kind of, in the same kind of way that we were supposed to attach to Tony, for good or ill, hero or anti-hero, but we just don't have he's not the same actor that Gandolfini was. He doesn't have the backstory. He doesn't have the history that we have. And I just think it was just maybe a mistake to go with this character and expect us to kind of empathize with this murderer. So I don't know. It just didn't quite work. Bad decision, in my opinion.
I mean, I do think if you're trying to cut it down to a length, the stuff that probably goes is just the like leavening jokey moments. But I would remind you, Dave, we did learn that Tony wasn't at that card game where everyone got arrested, including his dad, because he was farting too much. So,
that's true. And also, we learned that the Venus de Milo would not have used a douchebag because she's handicapped.
Anyway, let's one last question. We've already talked about Harold. Was the mid-credits scene that set up, what do we think it was setting up a sequel about the further adventures of Harold, you know, in a further expansion of the Sopranos cinematic universe, you know, now that we're into the 70s, getting on to the 80s? If so, is that a story we would want David Chase to tell, Alan?
I mean, I looked at it when I first saw it a couple of months ago, more as just sort of like a stinger of, oh yeah, by the way, like Harold won.
Yeah.
He wins this war. Like, while Dickie was focusing on this other stuff, this is what happens. And everyone I know who saw it after me is like, oh, obviously they're setting up like a sequel season or a series.
Yeah.
I think there's definitely something to be done there. I would love to see Gandolfini play like Tony as he matures into, you know, late teens, early 20s, and actually gets into the mob. I would not hate that at all. Mm-hmm. I would certainly love to see more of Vera playing Livia because she's fantastic and doesn't get a ton to do here. I don't know that the Harold thing is it, but maybe if they have more time to focus on it, he can feel a richer character. I certainly liked Leslie Odom in the role.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it's just sort of it's sort of an underwritten part.
Yeah. Also, the Frank Lucas tie-ins, like, that's a real guy. I mean, that's also getting covered in Godfather of Harlem, too. Sarah, what do you think?
Yeah, I love that there was a fairly lengthy scene with Frank Lucas, and it's like, I am true crime guy, like I know who that is. And also, we all saw the movie with Denzel, but I felt like it was an excuse to just like costume this character, which I wasn't totally mad at. I was like, we don't need this, but I don't hate it.
Yeah.
I would watch that series, but I think he needs to sort of create it and break it out and then give it to other people to do. And but I mean, Leslie Odom is a star, and I would watch him play like all the parts in a Sopranos prequel. So, I mean, sure, give it a spin. I'll try it.
Yeah, have David Chase be the Soprano integration consultant on that series, and then I think you are good to have somebody closer to the material deal then.
Yeah.
For more from Alan on this and the Sopranos in general, we will link to his Ultimate Sopranos Insider's Guide to the Many Saints of Newark at Rolling Stone, as well as to his book, The Sopranos Sessions.
I hear it's good.
All right, it's time to go around the dial, talking about other things we have been watching on TV recently. First up, Tara.
Speaking of heroes of New Jersey, let's talk about the problem with Jon Stewart. He's from New Jersey, right?
Yes.
Okay. Right, Trenton. This show, wow. I will try not to repeat too much of what Alan wrote in his excellent and dead-on review, which we will link to, although subscription is required. But here are the main problems with The Problem with Jon Stewart, his new weekly comedy hybrid show on Apple TV+. And by the way, when I heard that term used in the pilot and realized that this whole class of commenting on current events shows has a genre title, it made me want to die. Number one, the length. Why is it longer than half an hour? It is 43 minutes. It has no commercials. You're not 60 minutes. No pun intended. Get out of here with that. Number two, the radical transparency. The first thing we see in the show is an editorial meeting among Stewart and a bunch of his writers, which, if you're going to identify them by their full names, not just their first names. So maybe people who are sufficiently interested in them can follow them on social media or rescue them from this bad show by offering them work elsewhere.
Oh,
these snippets may very well be completely authentic, but when you go to these lengths to nudge me in the elbows, I'll look how authentic this is. It just makes me feel like it's fake. Sorry, I'm Gen X. It's how I was raised. But you know who else is Gen X? Jon Stewart. He should know better. Number three, the opening credits. I just watched when Dave was about to walk the dog out. I was like, come back and watch this because they were so embarrassing. I almost did not survive them. They are so cringe.
I describe them as creative consultant Henry Rollins is here to really tell you where it's at.
No.
It's in a big, bold, industrial-looking font montage of what are obviously rejected titles for the show, one of which was Shit Show, which maybe should have left that one on the whiteboard a little longer. But the music coming back to sampling the free tracks on Pond 5 so we could use 90s-sounding ones in our sassy podcast, except the ones I picked for the podcast are good. This is generic.
Pond 5.
Pond 5. Huh? Number 4, John Stewart. Based on how rusty he is, and Alan commented on this as well, you would think he retired from The Daily Show 15 years ago. It was only 2015. It is, at times, painful to watch him. He is straining so hard to make this weird thing work. 4A is the editing, which could be tighter when there's a noticeable lag after we come back to Stewart after a clip package. Tells you either they're hiring inexperienced people to cut it or the editor is deliberately trying to sell him out. And finally, number 5, the content. I stopped watching A Closer Look on Late Night this year because even though they're very funny and very well written, I find them stressful. I'm aware of the news. I just don't find these shows entertaining anymore. And I quit Last Week Tonight for the same reason. They obviously do a lot of research. They shed light on stories that aren't discussed enough. But this is not how I want to consume this stuff or learn about the world. So I guess take everything I'm saying about the problem with Jon Stewart with a grain of salt because I don't like these shows. But even people who like Full Frontal or whatever else, I think, would agree the issue with Stewart's new show is structural. Like, a typical Last Week Tonight segment is mostly an info dump, but every few lines or paragraphs, you get a joke analogy about, like, a raccoon named Clive in a barrel. Get out, Clive, you don't fit, etc. But Stewart's show is all info dump, no jokes almost at all. And it's not as though I think the main story of the pilot, which is about health issues combat veterans have suffered from burn pits and war zones and how the VA isn't treating them, or even acknowledging them, kind of, is not. It's very serious and important, obviously. The question is whether the right person to tell these stories is Jon Stewart. I feel like the rationale behind making the show is to let the comedian do a little goof around so the tough stuff goes down easier. That's been the case with other ones, other comedy hybrids, but they forgot to add the goof around part. So this is 43 minutes of righteous and totally deserved fury from a guy. Like, do this show with a journalist, put it on PBS. This thing is a weird experiment. I stand by what I said on Twitter. All the money Apple spent on the problem with Jon Stewart should have been allocated to make the season of The Morning Show twice as long. Don't watch the show, but if you're determined to ignore me, new episodes drop Thursdays on Apple TV+. Alan, you disagree with the last part. Go ahead.
It's The Morning Show. I'm sorry. There's too much of it already. There's too much already.
Disagree.
Massachusetts.
Moving on to my lowbrow pick, I have wonderful news for Sarah D. Bunting, which is our revenge is back. It's on Fox. The whole cast is black, and it's called Our Kind of People. Instead of the Hamptons, we're in the Oak Bluffs on Martha's Vineyard, historically a vacation spot for very wealthy black Americans. Angela Vaughn, played by top model alumna Yaya DaCosta, has recently lost her mother, Eve, and only found out on her death, it seems, that Eve owned a boarding house on the island. There's some business blah, blah involving the black hair care company that Eve founded, which Angela's running now and trying to take to the next level. But the real issue is that Eve kept secrets, like, for example, who Angela's father was. And when they get to the island, they meet the premier family, the Franklins, who have successful businesses and a bunch of philanthropies, are at the top of the social hierarchy and also have secrets. Angela immediately clashes with Leah, the presumed heiress of the Franklin business, and maybe Angela and Leah have more in common than anyone thought. You see where this is going. The cast also includes Debbie Morgan as Angela's aunt, Morris Chestnut as Leah's husband, still so hot, by the way, and Joe Morton as Leah's father. And like Fantasy Island, this is not a real heady undertaking. It is a good, chewy caramel of a primetime soap. The fashion and the styling are gorgeous. Everyone in it knows exactly what they're supposed to do. It's really fun. It's on Fox Tuesday nights. Our Kind of People.
Sold.
For my plug. And again with Again this week, that is our Patreon for the Again with This podcast. We are all three, Dave included, going to be talking about the 13th annual Circus of the Stars, which aired on Thanksgiving Day in the year 1988. The reason that we're talking about it is because, quote, Brian Greene, the energetic young star of Knott's Landing, is in it doing tumbling.
Sensational. Oh my God.
But it also features Bea Arthur as the ringmaster, Louis Anderson, Marsha Warfield, John Biner, Emma Sams, a bunch of other people, including O.J. Simpson doing magic. It's crazy.
Yes.
So to hear us talking about that this Friday, you need to subscribe to our Patreon. That is patreon.com/againwiththis. I feel it will be worth it.
Oh, my God. I just Googled Brian Austin Green in Circus of the Stars, and this is a life-changing image.
Yeah, oh my God. It is.
It's
wow.
It's a lot of
information. Yeah. None of it good.
All right, Alan, what have you been watching lately?
All right, so
now that your corneas have been burnt to a crisp.
Yeah, in a very different direction from both Circus of the Stars and The Many Saints of Newark, Friday, Netflix dropped a show called Maid, which stars Margaret Qualley, who you might know from The Leftovers or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood or just from being Annie McDowell's daughter. She plays, it's based on Stephanie Land's memoir about being like a single mom, leaving an abusive relationship and having to work as a house cleaner just to sort of escape homelessness. And it follows roughly the path of the book, although there's a lot of fictional embellishments within it. I knew nothing about this show. Friend of the podcast, Linda Holmes, just started texting me one day saying, have you seen the show Maid? I think you should see it. I think it's really good. And I went in knowing nothing. I was absorbed right from the jump. Qualley is in like every scene of the entire show, and it's sort of a big like star type performance, not in a glamorous way because she's, you know, cleaning up shit, but because like she just radiates this charisma and this likability and this watchability that makes you want to stick with it, even though some of the material is very tough and then other parts of it are really light and fun without undercutting the seriousness of what she's dealing with. It comes from a bunch of people who worked on Shameless. And it has most of the things I liked about Shameless without almost any of the stuff I did not like about that show. So it's a very good combination. It's only, I believe, 10 episodes, self-contained, limited series. Very satisfying. One of the better things I've seen so far this year.
Nice.
Cool.
And for my plug, since Tara already mentioned The Soprano Sessions, I will mention that I have a podcast called Too Long Didn't Watch. The premise is in every episode, celebrities and I pick out a show they've never seen before. I show them the very first episode, the very last episode, and nothing in between, and they have to figure out what the heck happened. So, you know, you've got like Alison Brie watching Game of Thrones, Jon Hamm watching Gossip Girl, Kumail Nanjiani watching Veronica Mars, and on and on. It's a lot of fun. There's 10 episodes already available now. The second season will hopefully be debuting later this fall, but you can subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh, God. Okay.
Poor Sarah.
Working Girl, the TV show.
Can I, a question.
Yeah, why? That's my question.
Title.
Wait.
Is that part of the title? The TV show?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought we were back to that. Because remember when movies based on other things was always the movie and it was the dumbest thing ever? I wish it was called a TV show. Dang.
Hot Dog the Movie and Hamburger the Motion Picture.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's a long story, but it involves like looking at the right rail and being on YouTube and being like, fuck out of here. And then clicking on it like the right rail dared you, which is totally what it wants you to do. And then 11 minutes later, you're like, why is this? Anyway, a lot of connective filaments in this. I did watch the entire pilot since I am never going to get those 23 minutes back. Here is my attempt to make this like pertinent to anyone's life. Here's what you need to know. It's loosely based on the movie with Sandra Bullock in the Tess role, Nana Visitor as her bitch boss. Not one to watch after this shit, George Newbern, as Everett Waspy name, probably the love interest, I will never find out. And hey, it's that Law and Order defense attorney, Tom O'Rourke, as the big boss, Mr. Trask. The show bowed in April of 1990 and aired 7 of the 12 episodes that were made. The last episode that aired at the end of July, so evidently it was eating sufficient shit against summer reruns in the ratings that it still got pulled. This is not a surprise. Wow. It is not good. And the main problem is that this particular story wouldn't seem to have anywhere to go over the course of a sitcom season. Pertinent to our previous discussion? Maybe. Tess lands the junior executive job by the end of the premiere. Spoiler, unquote. And then it's just a fish out of water slash workplace sitcom trying to coast on the strength of a watery version of the film's theme song. Bullock's not inconsiderable charm getting strangled by an uneven Staten Island, quote, accent. Etc. We have watched worse, see the Finelli boys. And if anyone was going to put this over somehow, it was the writers on the premiere script, which is credited to Robin Schiff, who created Gross Point, and a guy who did a couple other little things, name of Lawrence Connor, wrote Many Saints of Newark. But as Connor most certainly knows, some stories are features and some stories are series, and this one was a feature and should have been left alone. Do not watch it. Speaking of features that became series. Dave,
I just
the
have
movie.
An important fact for you. Okay. What do you think George Newbern did after Working Girl? What was the next thing he worked on?
I know, so I will recuse myself.
Is it Father of the Bride?
Nope. I know for sure Sarah's watched it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
It's a little show called Puchinsky.
Puchinsky!
With Peter Boyle as the guy that sucked into a body of a dog. And he's also a police detective.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God. All right. Speaking of features that became series, Frequency, starring Dennis Quaid. It's a season or two away yet, but I'll be discussing it on my chronological survey of Quaid's entire career with Jeb Lund, Quaid in full. And in the meantime, we are back for season 5, which covers the late 90s. And our first guest for that season premiere on Dragonheart was Mr. David T. Cole.
Yes.
Yikes.
Yikes. Yes.
Sarah, I love Frequency. If you need a guest, I'm there.
All right. You can fight John Ramos for it. Just kidding. The more the merrier. We would love to have you. T-Bone will be back as well later this season, we hope, for The Parent Trap. But in the meantime, Quaid in Full is wherever you get your podcasts. Stay up to date on Twitter at Quaid in Full Pod. We have many fantastic guests. And Alan, thrilled you want to do it.
Yikes!
Oh, good. You saved it too.
Same.
Sean Connery as a dragon saying yikes. How could
Permanent
I not say that?
Soundboard entry. Totally.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from Rebecca R. It is called Bad Apples, and Rebecca writes, "It's hard to watch a show, no matter how good or beloved, once you find out about the horrible real-life behavior of one of its performers." One if you're lucky, by the way. For example, OG Roseanne is such a good show. It was funny, featured actors that looked like normal people, and told stories of working-class families. But how can you rewatch now, knowing its star and creator is a racist? Yep. Please rescue a great show with a problematic performer by recasting his, her, their part with an actor you think could not only do the job, but maybe even improve it. Oh, Rebecca. This one really struck home for me because for a while, one of my freelance gigs was writing streaming recommendation posts themed around a topic like movies about holidays, cooking and food, weddings, whatever. And the problem with that job was when I could come up with the mandated 25 titles and then feel like I should cut 3 that fit the brief but featured the work of one or more alleged sex criminals, which would happen basically every time. The thing about this prompt is how we're extremely spoiled for choice, so that's why I have multiple options. The very obvious one is The Cosby Show, which I loved in its day, but you know, instead of Dr. Cosby, do you know who's almost his age and hasn't been credibly accused of several dozen sexual assaults? John Amos. So that's my pick to send you back in time.
That'd be good.
My backups. I don't know if I'll be able to watch Peep Show or that Mitchell and Webb look again now that I know Robert Webb is a TERF who had the chance to retract his comments this year and didn't really. So can someone please let David Mitchell know his new comedy partner is Jack Davenport? It's my pick there. And one final one, instead of Isaiah Washington, the new Burke on Grey's Anatomy is original Vanessa Williams, the Melrose one. And if you think you don't want to see her making out with Sandra Oh, you are insane.
Who's John Davenport?
Jack Davenport is the choreographer from Smash.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Alan.
All right. So this is one I wrote about. I wound up having a very contentious interview with the co-creator of this show about. That's The Deuce, which I thought was a really terrific show.
It was.
Unfortunately, was a show about sort of the sex trade and the many different ways in which women are abused and exploited. And it just unfortunately happened to star James Franco, who has his own real life history with this that involved, at least alleged, that involved a recent legal settlement. You know, when the show ended, I talked to David Simon about it, and he did not seem to have an issue with having Franco having starred in the show.
No.
I think it was really good. I think Franco was very good in it, but a lot of people could have played that role, including Jake Gyllenhaal. You could have made it an all Gyllenhaal show.
Yeah.
I think he could have played both the twins, both the really sleazy one and the semi sleazy one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he would have loved to wear the mustache for a number of seasons. And I know that there is one scene where one of the two Franco twins eventually hooks up with Maggie's character briefly, and that would have had to be worked around, or maybe the Gyllenhaals would have been into it. I don't really know, but I do think the Gyllenhaal could have played that part. And, you know, that's now a show I'd never want to revisit, and I would if somebody else was in the lead.
Yeah.
This is a job for deepfakes.
Sarah.
I also replaced Franco on a show. We'll get into it first. This is not the brief, but dishonorable mention to Matt Lauer, who keeps showing up in contemporary TV news snippets and true crime docuseries. It seems like producers have finally grokked that this is not okay, but in case that isn't clear, this is not fucking okay. If he's the only one you have footage of that's too fucking bad, Ken burns some shit over a newspaper clipping instead. Thank you. I'm not a crackpot. My real answer is replacing James Franco on Freaks and Geeks with Paul Rudd. We have proof of acting concept from Wet Hot American Summer, in which Rudd basically was playing Daniel Desario anyway. And yeah, he's 10 years older than Franco, but does not look it. Also, I recently informed Tara of this fact, and now I am broadcasting it wide in case anybody missed it. Paul Rudd co-owns a candy store with his wife and with Hillary Burton and Jeffrey Dean Morgan in Rhinebeck and is an activist on behalf of kids who stutter. I've never heard a bad thing about the guy and will not say a bad thing about the guy. Paul Rudd is in. James Franco is out. And you know what? Give him anything that Franco did. It's fine.
All right. I'll close this out. This is a show I don't think is super awesome, but I really enjoyed the first couple seasons of Community. Mm-hmm. And so Chevy Chase has to be removed. And this is an exercise we do on its own, not because just a general asshole on set, but because Pierce could be withdrawn from the show and not really change the show that much. But if you had a better actor who would do more with the role, then perhaps the Pierce wouldn't be the Pierce anymore. Who's to say? I'm going to give you four choices who would replace Chevy Chase as Pierce Hawthorne in Community. Peter Capaldi, Clark Peters, on The Wire, Freeman.
Yep.
Stephen Root
or
Charles Dance.
Oh,
Take your pick.
Root.
He really has the range. True. It's true.
I think that he might be the winner there.
Yeah.
That means it is time for The Canon. Presenting this week is our guest, Alan Sepinwall. Take it away, Alan. What do you got?
All right, so the last year and a half has largely ruined my appetite for cop shows, with one notable exception. Columbo. As the dogged, rumpled homicide detective, Peter Falk didn't use a gun, didn't really use physical force at all, and his targets were almost exclusively wealthy old white guys who thought they were too clever or powerful to ever get in trouble for the evil things they did. Even in 2021, I can still get behind that. Especially when the show built around that concept remains as fun and as durable as Columbo. It's been our family's big comfort food binge this year. For the canon, I want to talk about one of my favorite episodes, the season 4 premiere, An Exercise in Fatality. It has all the elements you want from a classic Columbo, most notably a smug rich killer who's certain this shabby little runt of a detective can't possibly figure out what he did and how, along with some tweaks that make it stand out from the series overall. Our bad guy this time is Robert Conrad as Milo Janis, a celebrity fitness guru. If you're old enough to know, he's basically Jack LaLanne. Who has set up a whole health club franchise in and around Los Angeles. When one of his franchisees, Gene, threatens to expose his corrupt business practices, Janis strangles Gene to death, then stages the body to make it look like a lethal workout accident. Conrad was a bit unusual as a Columbo guest star because the show was always a battle of wits between Columbo and the killer. Now, Janis is still pretty clever. He does some stuff with, like, a tape, an answering machine, and some other things to stage the crime. But he was still this super swole dude, especially by mid-70s standards, and his physicality was presented as something to give him the edge over the lieutenant. Most Columbo killers are amused by him, if not outright charmed, where Janis pretty much hates this twerp's guts from the jump and keeps trying to physically intimidate him. In one of my favorite sequences, Columbo does his usual move of showing up where and when the killer least expects it, just to throw him off balance. But Janis turns the table on him by forcing Columbo to follow him on a brutal run along the beach while Columbo is dressed in his usual suit, overcoat, and crummy shoes, leaving our man exhausted, soaked in sweat, and a little too distracted by the time he can finally ask his questions. But Columbo's never very intimidated, and Peter Falk still gets to do his thing. A lot of this is just him soloing. Like, there's an early scene where we hear his end of a phone call with Mrs. Columbo, where they're trying to, like, you know, have family over and they can't figure out what to serve and what he has to get at the store. or there's a scene he gets very exasperated waiting for the information he needs from a computer data firm whose receptionist may as well be a robot herself. But he's just as good agitating Janice or charming his secretary. And from time to time, the Columbo formula meant that the bad guy would wind up hurting or killing someone else to prevent them from talking to Columbo. Here it's Jean's widow Ruth, who is so shaken up by a dinner meeting with Janice that she nearly has a fatal overdose of alcohol and pills. This leads to a great outlier scene for the series where Columbo gets genuinely angry with Janice, and it's great to see Falk turn on the righteous indignation like that. All of this leads to the signature piece of any Columbo episode, the gotcha monologue, where the lieutenant explains how the killer did it. Falk doesn't have a stereotypically mellifluous voice, but he is a champion talker. And by this stage of the series, you got the sense the writers knew what kind of words and sounds it would be fun to hear him say again and again. He has a mild speech impediment when it comes to the letter L, for instance, and this episode not only involves him looking for a man named Lewis Lacey, but giving a speech at the end where he has to say the words laces, loop, and clothes many times in a row. Usually with these submissions, I try to offer audio snippets from throughout the episode, but in this case, I wanted to leave room for a lengthy section of the gotcha monologue because it's a very satisfying one. So, Dave, let's hear our one and only clip, please.
See, I knew there was something about these shoelaces that was bothering me. I just couldn't put my finger on it. Yes. Look at this photograph. This is a picture of Mr. Stafford's sneakers. It was taken when the body was discovered. You'll notice that the first loop, which you can always identify, it's the top loop. The first loop is on the side of the little toe. Now look at this shoe. This is Mr. Stafford's shoe. I found it in his locker. Now this is the interesting point. When I tie my own lace, the first loop is on the side of the big toe. When Mr. Stafford ties his own laces, the first loop is on the side of the big toe. This matches with this. However, when I tie somebody else's shoe, the first loop is on the side of the little toe. And this matches with this. There's only one conclusion. Mr. Stafford did not put on his own sneakers. Somebody else did. And that somebody was you. You changed his clothes.
Now, you wait a minute, Lieutenant. I'll tell you something. Your little demonstration proves one thing and one thing only. That somebody else put on Stafford's gym shoes. But the fact remains you can't prove that I did it. It could have been anybody.
It could only be you. By your own admission. It had to be you. Mr. Stafford was last seen around 7:30 wearing his business clothes. Now he's alone in the building. The building is locked. And the next morning he's found dead in his gym clothes. And at 9 o'clock the previous evening, 9 hours before the body was found, you and you alone knew that he was in his gym clothes. You said so. You swore to it in front of 5 witnesses. How did you know he was in his gym clothes? If you didn't change the clothes.
I love that music in print.
Oh, yeah. So like I said, I've been watching a lot of Columbo lately, and I had a hard time picking which one to present because they're all really entertaining. Like most Columbo episodes, there's some padding here or there in this episode. There's like a really long scene where Ruth meets Lewis Lacey without Columbo around. I have no idea where we're watching that, but most of it's a blast. An Exercise in Fatality has a lot of things you'd expect from almost any installment, like the killer trying to make it seem like the murder happened at another time than when it did. But it also has certain aspects, particularly in the Columbo versus Janice dynamic, that makes it stand out from the show as a whole. Just one more thing. I hope you'll consider it for induction into the canon.
Thanks, Alan. Sarah, why don't you start us off?
I really enjoyed watching this. I especially enjoyed watching it with my husband, who I think is the one person in the this little viewership group who was like legitimately sentient when this aired, which was September 15, 1974. So like a month and a half after Nixon resigned. So there's a lot of like dirty money and taping stuff happening in this that I think is like really on point for the zeitgeist in at this time in 74. But they don't do a ton of underlining of it because they wouldn't have had to. Everybody in the country understood that this was like reflecting that. So that was sort of an interesting part of it. The cars, the fonts, that giant like Whopper computer that is taking ages with the printout.
All the wood paneling.
That actually sort of reflects forward to the end of All the President's Men. Not that it knew it was doing that. That seafood restaurant towards the end, and the fact that like this poor widow is just like, I think she was already trending into alcoholism, and like people are just like people are just drinking all the time, like 9 a.m. this, you know, there's the secretary in her like perfect 70s bikini at the boss's house, just having a G&T in like a pint glass. It's supposed to be like 9:30 in the morning because they're on their way. And then they're going to the office. They're going to drive to the office. 1974, ladies and germs.
She's just a good secretary. She's just always available.
Yeah, I mentioned this on our colleague Craig Calcaterra's baseball blog today, that it was like, what did you do without baseball last night? Well, I watched a Columbo, and he immediately remembered which one it was because of young Gretchen Corbett in her bikini. This was so, like, there were a lot of sort of issues with it, but it's like all Columbi. It's like very entertaining. Even the slow parts, you have like a lot to look at, especially in the 70s ones where it's like, is that a tabletop lighter with a foot operation pedal? Like, oh my God. Like just people eating sandwiches during scenes. I mean, it's just very, it's very entertaining, even when by the standards of 2021, it is a lot of filler and slow. And I definitely, like, my husband was, first of all, horrified by the workout form of extras in the scene. Mm-hmm. And then went down a wiki hole about Columbo's car, which is a Peugeot, in case anyone else is writing a book. But we were definitely talking about, like, have we ever seen Columbo get mad that way before? Like, have we seen him sort of, like, you know, be frustrated instead of, like, compelled by the story that he is telling? Have we ever seen him lose it in that way? And Dan was like, I don't think we have. And that was part of what set this apart for me, was that moment that you don't usually see, where Falk, you know, to get that glimpse of him, like, really caring and being pissed off, was interesting, diverting. I'm not totally sure, based on that climactic clip that we heard, that actually seals the, like, I think there is a plausible answer to his, like, how'd you know if he was in his gym clothes if he didn't change the clothes? Like, well, it's just based on his word anyway. So I'm not sure it proves what it thinks it proves. But I do think Alan's canon case proves that Columbo is a great and enduring show. Without even mentioning that a mustacheless Schneider from the original One Day at a Time was in this, wearing a series of very diverting outfits.
Oh my God, just plaid pants.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't need to see them on him necessarily, but I might want a pair for myself. It's just like, Columbo is such an interesting case too, because so much of old TV is like, I understand why people thought this was great, but it doesn't translate now. But not only does Columbo generally translate, but it's almost hard to see why. There are just so many, like, sui generis things about it that let it work still. And it's always a pleasure to revisit it. In terms of it being canon worthy, like, this is going to be a tough one. Like, is this the first among relative equals? But I'm interested to hear what everybody else thought.
I feel like it is sort of like watchable and kind of, I don't want to say relevant, but at least like in COVID times, it is very comforting, I feel, because it is, mm-hmm. adjacent to slow TV now. Mm-hmm. You know, this is like a 2-hour TV movie series. It's a hybrid term. And it at once is watchable in the present day just because, like, it is a solid, fun mystery show. But also it is so fucking slow that it makes you watch everything else about it.
Yes. Yeah.
So yeah. You are absorbing the signs in the backgrounds, the weird little ticks of the characters, the fact
prints
that
on a dress or a shirt.
The mics are shorting on them as they're talking and walking.
Yep.
And it's they don't ADR at any point. Like all these little things that go into it. And you get like this weird, very holistic impression of how the episode was made, and it almost kind of like is a little time machine. It is very watchable today, as I think it was watchable at the time, but there's something really compelling about watching this in 2021. Gosh, I almost said 2020. That is delightful. And the fact that this episode has Robert Conrad as the jerky ass, thinks he can get away with it, white guy, after having watched from the next year, contemporary 1975, his episode of Battle of the Network Stars, where he is pretty much coming off as this character. This was maybe a couple months ago where I talked about this in Around the Dial, but he is a total jackass in this episode. And it really is pretty close to Milo in this episode, except you're swapping track suits for gold Ankh necklaces.
Oh,
tight
God,
shirts with giant
nestled
collars.
Nestled in chest hair. What a moment.
Robert Conrad kind of elevates this episode for me. Like, he is such a jackass, I believe, in real life. And so he really sells it in this episode. I don't think he had to work that hard. And just like 1,000 tiny things about this episode that are truly delightful. Like, Milo Janis has this franchise of Milo Janis health spas. Inside of a Milo Janis health spa, the Muzak is playing the Milo Janis radio jingle over and over again, which is madness. Just like weird little things like that. There's a kiss between him and the secretary where Robert Conrad has no idea what to do with his hands. He's not sure what's appropriate at this moment. And he's just
This was another note that Dan had, which was like he kept a little hashtag thing of like how many times it was obvious that they just used the first take. And it was like 12. Like there were a lot of Andrew Hsu moments where it's like, was there even a director or?
Yeah. Nobody noticed the Frankenstein arms. Kiss me happy. There's a scene where Robert Conrad's character is fussing around with the tape, which Ellen was talking about. And he is just walking around his own house doing tape stuff. And then he like goes into the room and he walks back. And all during that, this is the music. It is not an intense scene, but this is the music you hear during him puttering around in his own house. Around, grabs his drink, goes in the other room, takes the screw off the bottom of the answering machine, puts it back on, walks back in the other room. This goes on. This clip is 3 times as long as what I've played so far.
And this is like from the Pond 5 of the early 70s, because I'm pretty sure that's the music that plays when like a Brady child is trying to repair a piece of furniture that they broke and they're trying to get it over.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm still on the little delightful points, by the way. The gym crime scene, a couple things that I loved. One, there's an old guy in underwear that just pops in one of the thresholds for a moment. You're like, is he wearing a towel? Oh my God, no, that's giant old man underwear.
Yep.
That's like
is he
this
wearing
long.
A towel? Oh God.
You know, for those old man long testicles, it'll hold them all.
Yep.
And then also something you don't see in shows anymore, but I feel like you saw a lot at the time, super old beat cops. There was like a 65-year-old beat cop in that scene that was like generally milling about and helping with the processing of the crime scene. And he looked like he was older than anybody in Barney Miller.
I mean,
that's how old he was.
It was the 70s. That guy who looked 65 to us could have been like 37.
It's true.
I mean, Peter that's Falk true. In this episode was Chara's age.
Yeah.
So... Yeah, like old came quickly for everybody back then.
Sarah was talking about the seafood restaurant, or as it was shown in the episode,
seafood
restaurant. Mm-hmm. Never seen seafood as two words before on a sign.
And then that like Vegas, like the twirling light bulbs, then you cut inside and it's like just this, you know, classic
rigging.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like Master and Commander inside with red lamps. Yeah.
Oh boy.
It's fantastic. There's a scene in the hospital and this lady's wearing the world's largest hat. Doesn't need to be in there, but I loved it. The lady with the large hat, Columbo, he's a weird guy.
Super psyched to be eavesdropping on this too. She is my people.
Okay. But the standout moment for me in this episode that was really like at once enraging, delightful, of its time, would not be tolerated today, is an 8-minute scene in which Columbo gets an address of Mr. Lacey from a secretary at a data company, Sarah.
And, well, you should finish your own, your summary, because the button is my favorite.
Okay. So he goes to this company where this guy worked, and he goes to reception, and he's like, I need some information on Mr. Lacey. And she types it into their computer database, and it slowly, slowly prints on their teletype printer of the era. Mm-hmm. And he is convinced that something is wrong. So he asks her about 6 times if it is working and if we could hurry it up. And did she get the information? Maybe she can just use the phone, et cetera, et cetera. It just goes on. I'm not joking. It is 8 minutes long. It is crazy how long this scene is. And really, the point of it is he just gets this dude's information from her. And so they're printing it up, and it is printing for a good 3 minutes of that 8-minute scene. And he's complaining again. And at the end of it, she pulls it out and gives it to him. And I swear to God, the last thing on the page, it says more question mark, like a prompt if there's actually more background on this guy. I thought that was going to be the capper. That after this 8-minute scene and he gets the 2 pages of printed material, that she's going to say, oh, wait, there's more. And it would have doubled the length of the scene. It didn't happen, but I think maybe they shot it.
Well, and then he calls, is baffled by an answering machine. After the beeparoonie, he leaves a message, and then he's like, what a time to be alive. He leaves, gets in the elevator, and I'm like, you left the fucking printout at the payphone, bro. After all of that, he leaves the printout at the payphone. The elevator doors reopen. He's like, oh yeah, grabs his cigar that they made him put out, gets back on the elevator. I'm like, get the printout. I mean, art, truly.
That printout, so bizarre. That printout had Lewis Lacey's fucking social on it.
Yes.
And they're just giving it away. He's like, yeah, sure, fine.
And whatever. After all that, Columbo and Lewis Lacey never meet.
No.
Not that we see.
Not that we see.
No. He meets off camera, yes, because it's more important that we watch Lewis Lacey meeting with Gene's widow for
and
some
refusing
reason.
Refusing drink and chicken salad sandwich, which that looked pretty good, actually.
Yeah, like in defense of the computer data scene, at least that's Columbo reacting to this. Like Peter Falk is doing comedy business. It's 8 minutes, and you're absolutely right about that. But it's Peter Falk in those 8 minutes as opposed to whatever's going on with Lewis Lacey.
Absolutely. And it is that comedy cycle where it's like, yeah, okay. Oh, my God. We get it. All right. This has gone on so long that it's ludicrous and I'm now liking it again. It is that. And it just goes back to my point that this is entertaining as sort of this weird adjacent to slow TV kind of thing. But instead of like slow TV, you're watching a fire, or slow TV, you're in a train going through the Alps. It's slow TV, you're watching Columbo solve a mystery, and that's sort of compelling in its own way. And there's all this like period dressing that you can enjoy, and these weird ticks, and just the production of it, that everything looks like a harshly lit set in Burbank somewhere, and it shows.
That's what it is. Yep. Nobody's had a hot oil.
Last point, and Tara, tell me if I'm about to step on one of your points, and I'll leave it to you. Of the time, bad people have beach house tropes. You're going to... Okay, all right.
Go ahead. You can take it.
You do it because you had the list.
Okay. Alan's point about cop shows being less palatable in these days, but also Columbo is sort of gets a pass because all of the perps on Columbo are shitty rich assholes is well taken. I will also note the reveal that Milo Janis has a house in Malibu was like the least shocking thing that ever happened, because Dave and I have recently watched some 70s like L.A. noir movies. We watched The Long Goodbye with Elliot Gould and Night Moves with the King, Gene Hackman. And in both of those cases, scumbags live at the beach. That's just how it goes. Also, shout out, since no one else mentioned it, the guy who plays Gene is the original Mort Seinfeld from Seinfeld, Jerry's dad. He's only in like one episode and then never came back. So he was probably sad for a while. I assume he has left us by this point. One of the worst things that Robert Conrad, who, by the way, shouts also to his thick thighs, safe lives. One of the worst things he does other than murder is making Columbo exercise. I really felt for Columbo in those moments, not just because he was like in his coat and suit and dress shoes jogging on the beach, but like, no, dude, I am a cop. Stand still
and
while I
lunch
interrogate
with some
you.
Vitamins. Oh, God.
Yeah. Yes.
Fox sells that. That was a great scene.
Yeah. But I have nothing else to add. We've obviously gone over like all of the padding in the episode. The time that we watched the assistant walk from like the bar cart to the door for 45 seconds for no reason. Like, we could just assume she was in the house once she opens the door from the other side, you know? The other thing that was very cute to me was that the big scandal that Gene is trying to get to the bottom of is basically Milo doing vertical integration with his business, which is completely what everyone does now. And even at this point, Lewis Lacey is like, he hasn't technically done anything illegal. It's just kind of shitty.
Yeah.
This was an extremely cozy mystery to enjoy. Especially considering under the screaming white L.A. sun. I loved watching it. So thank you, Alan, for bringing it to us.
All right. Let us put it to the official vote. Columbo, an exercise in fatality, by the way, you didn't mention A-plus title.
Yes.
Sarah D. Bunting, what do you say?
I am affixing the Ankh necklace of victory to this episode, I hope, and voting yay.
Yeah, me too. I will stand by the fact that this is a show in its current state that would never make it as a two-hour anything today, but it really works when you watch it today somehow for all the reasons that we've been talking about. So it is sort of a delightful watch, but at its core, a compelling, as Tara says, cozy mystery that is elevated by Peter Falk. Tara.
Milo Janis clamped me between his meaty thighs and did not let go. So that's a yes for me as well.
All right.
Yeah.
That means that Columbo Season 4, Episode 1, An Exercise in Fatality. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Gray Can.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for the winner and the loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
Just one note before I say it. We never said Columbo is streaming on Peacock now. So if you signed up for it for the Olympics and you were about to cancel it, but then you want to watch some Columbos, they were on YouTube at the time that Will Leach made his submission to the canon of the series premiere. But they, I believe, are not anymore because they're on Peacock now. So that's where you can find it.
But if you don't want to stick with Peacock, they are also on IMDb TV. So you watch them through Amazon, but with commercials.
Great. My winner of the week is the Union IATSE, of course, stands for the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees. They have voted almost unanimously to authorize a nationwide strike, which would be the first in the Guild's 128 years. This is mostly over extremely long hours and a lot of fuckery that's been happening because what qualifies as new media is A, not really new anymore, and B, like functionally no difference than any other production. But for more information on that, our friend Christina Frisch, who is a makeup artist, she worked on Glow and You're the Worst, and most recently, I believe, WandaVision that we talked about. She wrote about why she was voting yes for the Hollywood Reporter, and we will link that. So we are pro-union, union strong, go IATSE, get their ass.
Sarah, who is this week's loser?
Katie Couric, who is still sticking up for her old co-host Matt Lauer for some reason, excerpts from her upcoming book, which this is like far from the extent of her shittiestness. But yeah, she texted him after everything went down and was like, you know, basically, I'm on your side and let me know if you need to talk. And then the rest of the book has even more terrible takes and crappy comments about various people. And then I think we also are going to have to follow her journey towards love.
Great.
And a middle-aged Mr. Right, which obviously Tara and I are planning to buy this book as cheaply as possible. So stay tuned for a possible extra, extra hot, great book club on this. But yeah, for Couric to be this tone deaf, like so many opportunities to just not say so many of these things. And she was not removed from her own way. One wonders why.
Yeah. The "Oh no, they didn't" headline is Katie Couric reveals she is an asshole, which accurate. But anyway, the book is called Going There. It's out later this month. Dave.
Two things. One, we have gotten into the habit of putting all the winners and loser runner-ups in our Patreon Discord server.
Yes.
Just for everybody to see. So it's kind of fun. But there's one there that I kind of wanted just to quickly mention, which is
please,
the poor guy in Korea that had the Squid Game, yes, I will participate in the Squid Game phone number,
yep,
printed on the cards and is getting 4,000 calls a day.
Yes.
Forcing Netflix to go back and digitally edit the card so it has just like the Korean equivalent of a 555 number. Poor guy. Yeah. I hope that Netflix is sending some love his way.
Yeah. Yikes. Well, speaking of poor bastards, do you know what time it is?
Game time.
It's on Regulation Game Time.
Woo! Yeah.
We are between seasons, which means we are playing a non-regulation game time written by me. It is called Back to the Garden State.
Oh.
Our lead topic this week has inspired this game, which will be played in two parts. First, considering we're still in a pandemic, the cast of The Many Saints of Newark has stayed booked and busy. For this segment of the game, I'm going to give you the description of a show that an actor from Many Saints of Newark appeared in within the last 12 months. You tell me the show title for 2 points. If you need a hint, I will tell you what network or platform it was on, and then it's worth 1 point. And these are not necessarily all new shows. In part two, you're still guessing show titles, but this time it's just shows set in New Jersey, according to Wikipedia. And it's the same deal. If you get the title off the description, it's 2 points. After a hint, which is its network or platform, it is worth one. No free guesses. No show is in here more than once. And no show is in here that I couldn't confidently describe without having to look anything up, so nothing here should be too obscure. What is at stake? If Sarah or Alan wins, they get 3 steel meals for their team or self, plus the right to force and me to watch a show for Around the Dial in an upcoming episode. If Dave wins, he gets 3 steel meals to dole out as he sees fit, to add to the 2 he still hasn't distributed from last time, plus the right to make me create and supply a mid-season non-regulation game time at his discretion.
Once again, the fact that you're adding stakes to these really makes me both delighted but nervous because I really do want that perk.
Oh, I know.
Because once in a while, I get really busy and game time is a real 11th hour rush.
Dave woke up with a case of can't. So yeah, he's already got one of these in his back pocket. Why not two? Since this is a non-regulation game time, steel meals may not be used. There will be no Grossworth Equalizer challenge zones.
Question.
Yes.
Do I get some sort of non-New Jersey native bonus head start handicap?
No. This is a pretty easy game. You're gonna do well.
Okay.
So there's 24 questions plus a tiebreaker if needed or for just funds. So let's throw it to Picky to see who's going first.
We will start with David.
All right. So our order is Dave, Sarah, Alan. Are you ready to play Back to the Garden State?
New Jersey accent here, yes.
Oh, yes.
Baby, we were born to run game time.
Part one, The Many Saints of Newark cast in other TV shows. Okay. Dave.
Yeah.
Billy Magnuson appeared in this sci-fi dramedy about a tech billionaire and the wife he is desperate to control.
Yes. I know that show. We watched it and it was good.
It.
And creepy and weird. It was basically a better
devs.
Black Mirror devs combination.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I'm stalling called... because I can't remember the name. Uh-huh. I know that love is in it. It's not All for Love. 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 It's not Love Machine, although that kind of... it's called...
Three.
Made for Love.
Oh!
Nice pull.
Sarah D. Bunting. Alex Morph appeared in this comic book adaptation about a well-known superhero's cousin.
I don't know, and a hint won't help.
It might.
I don't think so, but right. Sure. Hint me.
It's on the CW.
Well-known superheroes. Oh, yeah. Okay. I know what show this is. I just don't remember the name of it. So I do not know. Buzz me.
Alan knows.
Supergirl.
Nope.
No?
Oh, though that's not the one he was in. But I guess I would have had to accept that if that was it. No, it's Batwoman.
Okay.
Damn it. They're all cousins now.
They're all cousins.
Wait, was he in the other one, though?
No.
Okay. Well, then it can't be that one.
I guess.
I'm just Alan. Playing. I just want Alan to
no,
be like.
Right.
I'm playing mind games right now. I feel like this is what I got to do to win this New All Jersey right. quiz.
Well, I don't think that he's going to mess this one up. Although maybe he will.
We'll see. Caucus.
Daryl Edwards appeared in this sci-fi thriller about an airplane that disappears and then mysteriously reappears with all its passengers 5 years later.
Oh, a Manifest.
Manifest is correct.
Aren't you glad I didn't say see caucus?
Dave, shut up.
Enough with the ho-hocus.
Dave.
Yeah?
Leslie Odom Jr. appeared in this animated musical set in and around a well-known American landmark.
Central Park.
Central Park is correct.
Shout out to writer and previous guest, Jeff Drake.
Jeff Drake, yep. For Sarah, Matthew Elam, appeared in this organized crime anthology series that takes place around the American Midwest.
Organized crime anthology series? Hint.
It is on FX.
Organized crime anthology. American Horror Stories? I don't know.
Anyone?
Jeez. Oh, Fargo.
It is Fargo.
Oh, okay.
For Alan, Julian Lerner appeared in this sitcom remake in which a boy's childhood memories are narrated by his older self.
Oh my god, that could be like 17 things. And I just watched a new show that's like that too. I'm gonna need the hint, Tara.
It is on ABC.
The Wonder Years?
The Wonder Years is correct. For 1 point. This is the only one that has not premiered yet, but I snuck it in just in case.
Wait, this one I'm getting?
Yes.
Okay.
Dave.
Great.
Yeah.
A show I had not had an opportunity to watch. Let's do it.
If you've seen the doc, you've seen the title in there.
Okay.
Ian Unterman will very shortly appear in this scripted true crime docudrama about the billionaire family at the center of the opioid crisis.
Jesus Christ. Can I ask who that is in the show? Like,
this
I don't even know.
It won't help you.
Oh, God. All right. Can you just read that whole thing again for me?
Ian Unterman
oh, yeah,
will
guy.
Very shortly appear uh-huh. in this scripted true crime docudrama about the billionaire family at the center of the opioid crisis.
I don't even know what that is in real life. Pills, pills, pills.
That is not correct. Sarah?
Dope Sick.
Dope Sick is the correct
Never
answer.
In a million Dope years.
Yeah. Sarah? Vinny Costanza appeared in this dramedy set at a lesser Ivy rocked by scandal.
Costanza.
Dramedy? God. The Chair?
The Chair is correct for 2 points. Alan.
Yes.
Corey Stoll appeared in this drama about the dissolution of the relationship between a tech executive and her academic spouse.
The Strain.
The Strain is not correct.
One of the best things about him being Uncle Junior is that they did not try to put him in a toupee like they did on The Strain. This show also did not put him in a toupee. It's Scenes from a Marriage.
Scenes from a Marriage is correct for 2 points. Dave.
Yeah.
Catherine Cates appeared in this long-running legal procedural about a specialized squad within the NYPD.
Okay. Catherine Cates?
Yes. That's not going to help you.
All right. Once more, please.
Catherine Cates appeared in this long-running legal procedural about a specialized squad within the NYPD.
Okay, the specialized squad. All right, I got the first part of the answer. It's Law and Order. Mm-hmm. Is that enough? Law and Order, the is it Special Victims Unit?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Okay, all right. I don't know the intros. I don't. Okay, yeah. Good. I'm glad.
Okay. Right. Sarah. John Bernthal appeared in this anthology comedy series from an ex-sitcom star / writer.
Hint.
It's on FX on Hulu.
The Disdain.
That doesn't help me or anyone. Benson the movie. I don't know.
No. It's The Premise was my around the dial recently.
Oh, right.
He went and worked at the...
The show that...
He's in the only, like, good episode of The Premise.
Oh, God. That's dark.
The show that looks at SEO and says,
meh. Exactly. All right. Alan.
Yes.
Leslie Margarita appeared in this sitcom about a 40-something bluffing her way into a career in book publishing.
Younger?
Younger is correct.
Nice.
Wow. Bang.
David T. Cole.
Yeah.
Talia Balsam appeared in this sitcom about a musical group reuniting during its members' middle age.
Oh. Girls Five Eva?
Girls Five Eva is correct. Sarah.
Boy, not knowing actors' names is really making me nervous on this game.
Most of these are just like had two lines in it, so it doesn't even matter.
Not Sarah. Watching any real TV is really hurting me, so don't feel bad.
Sarah. Yes? Vera Farmiga appeared in this biographical drama series about an infamous American designer.
Halston?
Remember, these are all... Halston is correct for 2 points.
She smelled the jockstrap in
Halston. She sure did.
Oh, boy. Glad I didn't watch that.
Mm.
She's only one episode. And finally, the last question of this round, and then we'll do a score break. Alan.
Yep.
Germar Terrell Gardner appeared in this sitcom about the older siblings of a teen pop star.
The other two.
The other two is correct for 2 points. Let's get those scores.
Speaking of the other two, the other two players are very close at the top. Alan is currently leading with 9 points, followed by Dave with 8 points. I am also present with 4 points.
That's not that big a spread. All right, part two. Yeah. TV show set in New Jersey. You each get 3 of these.
Okay.
David T. Cole.
Uh-huh.
This sitcom spoof revolved around a recovering addict returning to high school later in life.
Recovering addict returning to high school later in life. Boy, that premise, I feel like I should know it, but I don't. Is there a hint?
It was on Comedy Central.
Yikes.
These are from all time, by the way. These aren't ones from the last 12 months. These are just shows set in New Jersey.
I see. Okay. Recovering addict going back to school on Comedy Central.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, is...
3, 2, 1.
Is that the show? 3, 2,
no,
1.
You don't know.
No, I don't.
Contact.
Buzz. Anyone?
Strangers with Candy.
Strangers with Candy is correct.
Oh, okay.
Sarah D. Bunting. This reality show made megastars of its extremely tan Italian-American cast.
Jersey Shore.
Jersey Shore is correct for 2 points.
Shame tanning laundry.
That's right. Alan, this medical procedural revolved around a grouchy doctor with a pill problem.
Ah, Princeton Plainsboro Hospital, my favorite house.
That's correct. Dave. This period drama went inside the world of organized crime between the world wars.
Oh. Boardwalk Empire.
Boardwalk Empire, yes. Is correct.
That's the nice one.
Sarah D. Bunting. This superhero adaptation delivered note-perfect spoofs of sitcoms from various eras in TV history.
WandaVision.
WandaVision is correct for 2 points. Ellen. This dramedy, starring its creator, tells the story of a first-generation Egyptian-American 20-something and his family.
Rami. Love Rami.
Rami is correct, and I agree. It's a great show. All right, last question for each of you. Should we do a score break first?
I could splice the tape at some length and try to even this up, but I'm in last place with 8 points. Dave has 10 points. Alan has 13 points.
Last question is, of course, worth 5 points, as is our tradition.
All right. Dave.
Yes. Steel mail. Double my point.
This animated series features 3 anthropomorphic fast food items and their hirsute neighbor.
Aqua Teen Hunger Force.
That's correct for 2 points. Sarah, this unscripted series goes inside the titular entrepreneur's bakery and shows how he creates his elaborate confections.
What? Ace of Cakes? Cake Boss?
Close.
Something with cakes?
It was Cake Boss.
Cake Boss.
When I lived in Hoboken, my wife got me a cake from there 1 year before the TV show existed.
Wow.
Any good?
Was it good?
It was pretty. It was nice looking. I don't remember it tasting that great, but like it had the design that she wanted on it.
More like cool. Cake middle manager, am I right?
Yeah.
All right. So if Alan misses this one, Dave wins?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, Alan, you can...
Wait, hang on. If Alan fucks it up enough that the answer is so bad that we need to take 2 points away from him, then I win.
All right, okay. Alan.
Okay, hang on.
Let's get some mood music here.
All right. Alan, this sitcom is about a college student earning room and board as a wealthy family's live-in housekeeper and Manny.
I want Charles in charge of me.
That's it.
Nice.
Woo! Let's get the final scores.
Is this the score break music from now on?
I think it might be.
God. I finished with 8 points. Dave finished with 12 points. And just one more thing, our winner is Alan with 15 points.
Valued guest.
Does this mean I can now force you to watch something, Tara?
Yes. That's exactly what it means.
Oh my God, the power. Oh my God, the power.
Yes.
All right. Okay. This is going to be good.
There's also a tiebreaker that we can play just for funsies.
Yes. Let's do it.
Let's do it for one steel meal.
Okay.
Michael Imperioli appeared in this procedural/drama about a close-knit New York family working in the legal system.
Blue Bloods.
Sarah!
Dang. Nicely done.
Mm-hmm. Bay Ridge's own exterior shooting of the Blue Bloods house.
Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We recounted the many saints of Newark before going around the dial with stops at The Problem with Jon Stewart, Our Kind of People, Maid, and Working Girl, the TV show. Rebecca had us replace some real TV bad apples, and Alan successfully argued for Columbo's An Exercise in Fatality for the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Alan Sepawal was the winner of this week's Game Time from Tara. Yes. And we're all eagerly waiting to see what Tara is going to have to watch in the future. Next up, it is Running Marathons on Extra, Extra Hot Great, and right here on the next EHG Prime CSI Vegas. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
of the Ariano Arianos,
Sarah D. Bunting,
then came the RICO statutes,
and Alan Sepinwall.
I'm changing my name to Lois Lacey.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Grit.
Well, how would I know what to feed him? What'd you feed him the last time? You want to give him spaghetti? Give him spaghetti.